Professional Education Group Incorporated is pleased to present another outstanding seminar in Professor James W. McElhaney's Master Advocate Series. This program was recorded before a live seminar audience and is accompanied by a manual which complements the course content. This program is one of more than 40 programs available on audio and videotape produced by the CLE source, the Professional Education Group. A complete catalog of PEG's offerings, including the remaining titles in McElhaney's Master Advocate Series, as well as other outstanding lectures by our national faculty, is available by calling 1-800-229-CLE1. Jim McElhaney is among the country's most highly acclaimed lecturers in advocacy skill training. He is consistently applauded for his creative, practical, and energetic teaching style. Professor McElhaney is also North America's most widely read author on the art of advocacy. His classic Trial Notebook continues as a runaway bestseller. He holds the Joseph C. Hostetler Chair in Trial Advocacy at Case Western Reserve University School of Law in Cleveland, Ohio, and lectures exclusively for the Professional Education Group. It is our privilege to present James W. McElhaney.
Our program is Shaping Your Case to Win. We're talking about what the lawyer does with the facts in patting and pushing and turning and twisting and not making facts and not changing facts, but taking the raw gut stuff of a dispute and working the lawyer's craft so that what you have is a persuasive case that you present to the best of your ability. We're talking about the brainstorming, the thinking, the planning, the articulating of the theory of the case, how that is going to be presented in the dynamics of the trial. All of that is shaping the case. And to start out, we know, all of us know, that not only does it make a difference what the facts are and who the clients are and what court you're in and all of that, but it also makes a difference in who's trying the case. Who's on the other side makes a tremendous difference, and you're on the other side from the folks that you're opposing. You make a difference. And you know that's true. One of the things that I am fortunate enough to have done is meet an awful lot of different trial lawyers all throughout the United States. Some of them ordinary, run of the mind. Some of them special. Winners. Winners whose very presence in the case makes a difference in the outcome. I think in a sense, everybody wants to be a winner. Lots of times people talk to me and they say, okay, Mac, you've met these guys. What is there about them that sets them apart? It's an interesting question. It's an important question. And I want to talk about the qualities of winners with you for just a couple of minutes as we get started, because you make a difference in this entire process. There is no doubt about it. Before I tell you what the qualities are, and I'm going to do that, I'm going to tell you what they're not. And that may surprise you. The qualities of winners are not brains, law review, the right school, the right family, ethnic background, good looks, a golden tongue, or luck. Now, it's true that there is a certain quantum of talent and ability that you have to make it as a winner. But huge amounts of talent are not necessary. In fact, the history of the world and the history of the legal profession in particular is littered with wasted talent. The race is not to the swift. The race is to the determined. Everybody in this room has more than enough talent, ability, and brain to be the kind of lawyer that others look up to and say, there's a winner. Everybody does. So what are the qualities that set the top 1 or 2% apart? Well, let me go through them with you. Number one, they want to help others. The profession of law is a profession, and the profession means that it serves the people, that it exists for the people and not for ourselves, and that its primary goal and direction is to assist people in their problems. And folks who are oriented toward getting a BMW are not winners. They may get the BMW, but they're not going to achieve the kind of recognition that we're talking about. Number two, there's a mindset, a desire, a fierce desire to right wrongs. Winners are offended by injustice. There are wrongs everywhere. You read them about them in the newspapers every day. You see people who are the objects of unthinking bureaucracies. You see people who have been stripped of rights, of family rights, of personal liberty, through means or by people who have, in effect, taken from them something important or deprived them of the right to at least make their case. And when you see that, you ought to be offended. You ought never to lose your capacity to be offended by wrong. Once that happens, once you no longer care about wrong, then you're just a functionary. Then you're a bureaucrat. Then you are not a winner and you're not going to go to the top. Number three, winners are ethical. Oh, sure, there are people who cut corners, who have temporary flashes of prominence. But typically, the underlying character outs. This is, after all, with all the lawyers that we now have, it's still a small club. And what goes around comes around. And it's so easy to have a reputation as being somebody who you can't quite trust. If you're going to talk to him, you better get in writing. You know that there are lawyers like that, and the word is out on them. And the ones who are like that don't understand why the rest of the world needs everything in writing from them. They don't realize that the little corners they cut here and there come around and forge their reputation. It is a small club. And you ought to hear the judges talking. Oh, you ought to hear them. One of the prices of being on the circuit is you have to eat an awful lot of rubber chicken. And I was on the dais in Cleveland, Ohio, with all of the federal judges, save one. 11 of the 12 of the Northern District are on the dais. We're having lunch. It's the Federal Bar Association, and I'm to give a talk. They figure that because I'm a professor, I'm a teacher, that I'm harmless. And so they talked among themselves and with me as if almost I were one of them, because I wasn't a lawyer regularly appearing in front of them. I wasn't the other side. And so they talked. And you know what they talk about? They talk about us, folks. They talk about lawyers. They talk about who they can trust and who they can't trust, who will miscite a case and who would never miscite a case, who is going to be there on time, who is going to, when they make a factual representation, is going to back it up 100%, and who will cut a corner or mislead or create a false impression by a careful omission, which might not technically be a lie. It yet nevertheless serves the function of a lie most admirably. And they talk about us. And what I'm here to tell you is, folks, it's a small club, and winners are ethical. All right. Number four, winners want to know everything. They're voracious readers, and they have eclectic interests. And they read newspapers and magazines, and they talk to people, and they watch television, and they're interested in what's going on in town. They've got their ear to the ground. They're aware of what's going on. They care about what's going on. It makes a difference. They want to know everything, and they want to know everything about the case. They want to know what's right with it. They want to know what's wrong with it. They want to know why things happened. And when something doesn't fit, they're not at rest until they find out why it doesn't fit. Now, if you're content with saying, well, I don't care, it doesn't matter, it's not really going to be an issue here, no sense spending my time on that. Once you have that mindset, then, oh, that's okay, we can blow that off, it doesn't really matter, we'll probably settle anyhow, who cares? And you've heard people talk that way. They're not winners. Number five, winners, real trial lawyer winners, have a passionate need to communicate. They love to talk. They love to tell stories. They love to explain. It becomes an important need to be able to explain clearly, efficiently, effectively. Winners take responsibility for communication. We're taught so little about how to communicate. If you're going to do it, you have to largely be self-taught. Law school doesn't teach you how to do it. Law school teaches you how to be an appellate judge's clerk and how to talk to that appellate judge and maybe make an argument in a highly stylized moot court setting where everything is done in the language of the law. The language of the law sucks out all the humanity and leaves the bare procedural bones, where you're not representing men and women and groups of people, but you are representing procedural entities. Why did the law do that in the first place? Because of this erroneous notion that law is a science and that we can purify it by taking the humanity out and leaving only the procedural entities, thus sucking all the juice out of humanistic problems. We can approach true abstraction, and that's what we study in law school. What a shame. Our job is to communicate efficiently, effectively, persuasively. The law deals with human problems, and you represent human institutions and humans. And you got to learn to talk that way. And you weren't taught that in law school. And you need to communicate. You need to care desperately about communication. If you're talking to a judge or to a jury, the most important thing in your life at that time is to get that idea across. And when you encounter resistance, instead of just going on and ignoring the resistance, you try to fix what you're doing so that somehow you can get across that resistance. And you encounter an irascible judge who apparently isn't listening, and you try to think of some way to break through that barrier. Judges, because they're professional fact finders, think they've heard it all. And they develop a membrane, a protective membrane against the ordinary run-of-the-mind comments and arguments. And you have to learn how to penetrate that membrane. And if you don't, then you're not really communicating. Winners desperately need to communicate. They dedicate their professional lives to communication because the law is always involved in communication. You never, as a lawyer, whether you're an office lawyer, whether you're a courtroom lawyer, whether you're a labor lawyer, whether you are a family lawyer, no matter what you do, you are a professional communicator. Your ideas do not exist in a vacuum, and you do not sit there thinking great thoughts without communicating them. You write and you talk. And winners need to communicate. Number six, goals. Goals in a case, goals in your law firm or office, goals in your practice, goals in your professional life, goals in your personal life. Winners have goals. Great majority of the people in this country and all countries drift, guided only by their status, to do the next thing as it comes up. There are, of course, dreamers. And dreaming is important. But dreaming does not mean goals. The difference between an idle dream and a goal is a plan. Winners have goals, and that means plans. Now, I know you have all heard this thing about, oh, sometimes preachers will tell the story about the three bricklayers, and I know everybody's heard it, and it's instructive. Somebody's going and talking to these three bricklayers and says to the first one, what are you doing? First one says, I'm laying bricks. What do you think? Says the second one, what are you doing? He says, I'm building a wall. Says to the third one, I'm making a cathedral. Now, the third one is held up for approbation. Hey, there's the one with the dream, right? Well, a dream's essential. That end goal is essential. The winner's got it. But the winner knows where the next brick goes. If you don't know where the next brick goes, you're a dreamer. Without a goal, without a plan, you have only a dream. Dreams are fine. But to make them realities, you have to proceed purposefully toward them. And that is the plan coupled with the determination. And that's it. You got goal. Number seven. Imaginative. Oh, of all of the qualities that they test people for when they come to law school, imagination is at the bottom of the list. There is nothing on the LSAT to determine whether you're imaginative. And if you exhibit any imagination in law school, that's quickly snuffed out. Well, you're imaginative, huh? But we'll teach you. We're not interested in what might have been or what might be the right. Tell us what the court said. What about this? What about that? Very pertinacious, very precise. You've got to answer this way. You've got to understand what's going on. You have to have some insight into it. Oh, yes. You have to be very thoughtful about it. But planning what might be a better way to do it. Oh, wait a minute. That's not what our role is. We deal with precedent. And of course, you need to learn how to manipulate precedent to achieve the interests of your clients. But imagination is not a quality prize generally in the teaching of the law, and yet winners are imagined. They ask, why not, instead of why. Winners think of new ways to do things. Winners are the ones who change the law. They're the ones who say, what's the next step for the appellate court? They're the ones who think creatively how it might be used in a setting that hadn't been thought of before. Imaginative. You've been taught to sit on your imagination. That was wrong. Started working. Number eight, energetic and persistent. Energetic, oh yeah, it takes scads of energy to be a winner. It takes scads of energy to be the kind of trial lawyer that Louis Neiser, at age 78, Louis Neiser was still pulling all-nighters in the last 30 days before trial. Not every night an all-nighter, but when he was gripped with having to get a problem solved. And when in trial, often would pull an all-nighter. Where did he get the energy? Well, he's healthy. Took care of himself. But he cared passionately. And I want to share a secret with you. People say, hey, bald man, where do you get all that energy? And I know I have a lot. You will have as much as you use. If you're used to making great demands on yourself, you'll come through. Energy is important, and you got to have it pointed, directed. You don't just flail around. Your energy has to be purposeful. And part of it is being energetic, and part of it is being persistent. Being persistent means that you're willing to apply your energy to the point again and again. You get knocked down, by golly, you're going to get back up again. You're going to try it again. You may have taken the same point to the Supreme Court of the state five times. And each time you move a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And the persistent one is the winner. Realistic. I just talked about persistence, and you know persistence matters. You know persistence counts. But you got to be a realist, too. You have to know, ultimately, when you look at it, no matter what I've done, we better settle this one. Because we're not going to get megabucks on this one. There are too many flaws. There are too many problems. There are too many things that we're up against. And out of a realistic concern for my client, I better advise her. Take the money this time. This is the right way to handle it. You got to know when to hold them. You got to know when to fold them. And you've got to be realistic. You've got to know when to say, my advice is go with this. Take it to trial. You're taking a risk. I think that the risk is worth it. Your decision, but my recommendation is go for it. You've got to have a realistic sense, an evaluative sense that tells you, if this plays out, here's the way I think it's going to be. Part of your advantage of being a lawyer, said Bill Bartley, long time ago on Governor's Island, said part of your advantage is while you are involved and you care and you're dedicated to doing the best you can, part of your advantage is it's not you going to jail. And you can take a step back and look at the case realistically. And that realistic evaluation is one of the most important things that you can give your client. Finally, winners are not afraid to fight. The practice of law involves fighting. Oh, I know it's nice and warm and cozy to talk about ADR, alternative dispute resolution. It's cozy to talk about this as if this is all some kind of friendly little thing, and that we can discuss this over a cup of coffee and a conference table, and it'll all be chummy and come out. So that everyone's a winner. Well, that's a nice attitude with which to approach alternative dispute resolution. But I'm telling you, there are some things in the law that involve head-on collisions and insist on a resolution of rights and wrongs, and that there's no backing away from some fights. And that if you do, you're not serving the law, you're not serving your client, you're not serving your practice, you are just looking at the short-run gain, and that's it. There are times when you have to stand and be counted. And you have to have the realism to know when that is. And you have to have the stomach for the fight when it happens. Those are the qualities of winning. Those qualities are the thing that winners have. Nobody's got 10 in all categories. Everybody is flawed. Even your greatest heroes, Clarence Darrow, Daniel Webster, maybe Edward Bennett Williams, whoever, everybody is flawed. Nobody gets a 10 in all categories. But all winners have significantly high scores in most categories. The interesting thing about these 10 qualities is that they are yours by choice. They are yours by choice. The race is not to the swift. The race is to the determined. And now let's talk about determination and shaping the case. Okay? So I would appreciate it if you would turn with me to page 9, picking the right legal theory. And let's talk about picking the theory of the case, the legal theory of the case. The case comes into your office, and now you've got to determine the category or categories into which the case fits. In a law school, you are trained to identify every possible legal theory of the case. Remember maybe a practice exam in the middle of the first semester, and you took torts. And you had studied assault, you'd studied battery, you studied false imprisonment, you had studied those intentional torts first. That's because the law had taken the trouble to break those obvious wrongs. Everybody knows you shouldn't hit your neighbor. No big deal there. The obvious wrongs had been routinized. They've been broken down into elements. And the teachers wanted to see if you were able to deal with those elements and apply them to a particular set of facts. And so you had some simple question on this practice exam mid first semester of your first year. A strikes B, discuss. What are the causes of action here? A strikes B? Let me see. That's got to be a battery. Well, not necessarily. If it's a socially unpermitted touching, then it is a battery, because there is a touching and there's no question about that. And so you have to determine whether this is a kind of socially permitted touching like that is, or whether it's the unpermitted touching like that is. And you talk about that and you say, wait a minute. If he knew it was coming, it was also an assault. Now, if he didn't know it's coming, it's not an assault. And so we have to look at the knowledge of the victim of this to determine whether it's also an assault. And after you got done talking about all of the intentional torts, this could be involved also with a false imprisonment. Maybe force was used to restrain the movement of somebody. And under those circumstances, that could even be a false imprisonment. Although that's a little bit speculative, dealing with facts that we don't know about, but what the heck? We're looking at lines of inquiry that we're going to make. And then we go and talk about, wait a minute, you can have a touching that injures somebody that is not intentional. And that could be negligence. Now, with negligence, there's not merely negligence in the air. There is, what is the standard of negligence? Failure to do what an ordinarily reasonably prudent person would do under the same or similar circumstances, or doing something that they wouldn't do, which results in injury to another person. You can't just have negligence in the air. You have to have some kind of contact. You could have negligent infliction of mental distress coupled with some kind of contact. And wow, you're laying out this entire first half of the semester on A strikes B, and you turn in your paper and you go back home saying, I'm Charlie Potatoes. Wow, did I ace that one? And then the practice exam comes back, having been marked by the teacher, and you got a C. Now, it's interesting. What happens when you grade student work? If you give a student an A, they tell their classmates, I got an A, or I made an A. If it's a B, they're likely to say, I got a B. If it's a C, they say, he gave me a C. All right? And so now, this student who has never seen a C in her life goes to the professor and said, you gave me a C. Why did you do that? I discussed everything. Teacher picks up this thing and looks at it and says, I don't see any discussion of the warehouse receipts problem here. There certainly isn't any. And you say, what? What are you talking about? Warehouse receipts? This is crazy. You mean all that funny stuff you were talking about in class? That has some relationship to this? Why, of course. You're supposed to spot all the issues and discuss all the issues. It's not your job to throw issues out because you don't think that they're going to particularly prevail. You got to spot them all. Now, it is necessary to be able to identify all the issues, and no question about that. But you don't pick them all. Right? Lesson number one. A lawsuit is not a law school examination. The world will not reward you for picking the cockamamie theories that the teacher came up with that no appellate court has ever endorsed and which do not pass the giggle test. It's astonishing how many law firms comment about how new lawyers will talk about remote possibilities as if they are things into which the firm should devote tremendous amounts of time and money. It's as if these people had never heard of the giggle test. That if you can't say it with a straight face, you don't write it in the summons and complaint. And of course, they were rewarded with grades for ignoring the giggle test. Right? Number two, the legal theory's got to be simple. The more complex the legal theory is, the more difficult it is to explain to a judge or to a jury, the more difficult it is to make sense with a particular set of facts. The legal theory that you pick should be the simplest one that you can. People will not believe what they don't understand. True. There are times when one of the biggest jobs you have is explaining why something is wrong. We're going to talk about that a little bit later.
This is the end of Tape 1, Side 1. Our program continues on Side 2.
Number three, the legal theory's got to be plausible. And the factual theory, as it fits the legal theory, has got to be plausible. Now, what do I mean plausible? Well, I mean, does it appeal to people's sense of reality? When you structure a theory of the case, there are times when you run with evidence because you say, I've got a point here that ought to make it slam dunk. It happens in Florida, in a case where a kid was hit by a truck. What is called by the plaintiff as a pedestrian rundown, called by the defendant a child dart out. It's the same case, right? And the defense lawyer is working fast and furious, and he realizes that he's got a scientific theory that will prove, in his mind, that it was impossible for this truck to be going any faster than 21.6 miles per hour at the time that the truck hit the kid. It was a fully loaded truck weighing 12,500 pounds. It was going up a 2% grade. It had come to a full and complete stop at a red light, and they were only so many hundred feet from the light at the time that the kid was struck. The summons and complaint said that the truck was speeding and reckless and all of that. He said, hey, we can put the lie to that. We can prove scientifically no way this truck was going faster than 21.6 miles an hour. And so all excited, he runs to the senior partner, says, we can. Senior partner says, what? Says, we can prove this truck was going slow. Partner says, well, that's nice, but you know, let me suggest that you don't spend so much time trying to slow down the truck. Why don't you speed up the kid, Dad? What do you mean? Well, from a plausibility standpoint, people don't believe the trucks are driven slowly. Their life experience is the trucks are loud, noisy, fast, driven by people who have no regard for the sensibilities of other traffic or for the needs of other individuals or even for the common courtesies of the road. The common mindset is a trucker is an irascible, pushy kind of person, and they're not going to believe that the truck was going real slow. Oh, yeah, we can use this evidence, but as the center of the case, no, no. Now, what about kids? Everybody knows that kids can be impulsive. Everybody knows that kids sometimes don't look and watch and act carefully when they cross the street. Sometimes they run out into the middle of the street, ignoring the dangers that are there. One of the most important things you can do is look for the facts that speed up the kid, because people are more ready to believe that the kid darted out than they are to believe that the truck was being driven slowly and carefully. Not saying that we can't use that evidence. I'm saying that the thrust of this case has got to take into account the plausibility factor, says the senior partner. He's right. It's got to be plausible.
Number four, you will have one consistent legal theory. You know, it's the real scholar who comes out with a memorandum and gives it to the partner in charge of the litigation, says, there are 27 different theories that we can go with in this case. And it's the trial lawyer who says, give me the best one. Why? There is no law that says you have to have one theory of the case. There is no law that says that you have to have consistent theories of the case. You're absolutely entitled to have inconsistent theories of the case. If you want to sit where you can write and relax and all of that, you're more than welcome to move forward. I'll call on you back here anyhow. So I mean, if you haven't read the case, so there's no advantage to sitting here. On the other hand, you're close to the coffee. So whatever lights your candle, okay? Now, you don't have to have a consistent, coherent theory of the case. You can have as many as you like. The law affords you that luxury. And yet the cost is high. Let me tell you about Bob Hanley. The late Bob Hanley from Jenner and Block at that point represented MCI in the case against AT&T. Antitrust case, middle 70s, late 70s. And late 70s, early 80s. It started out in the late 70s and was actually tried in the Northern District of Illinois in Judge Grady's case, Judge Grady's court. Okay? MCI said violation of antitrust. And AT&T said, no way. And we've got 27 different theories. And they argued every one. AT&T was represented by a lawyer who had never tried a jury case before. Bob Hanley, who represented the plaintiff, had tried lots of jury cases before. And AT&T took one theory and they tried it out and they made one argument. And if people didn't seem to be receptive to that, they had another one. If they weren't receptive to that, they had another one. And that's the way they tried the whole case. Right before final argument, Hanley remembered an argument that Irving Younger had used in a NIDA court in the early 1970s in Boulder, Colorado. And he remembered this. And he wanted to make sure that he had it right because he wanted to make fun of AT&T's multiple theories in final argument. So it's a Sunday afternoon, right before final argument in Judge Grady's courtroom, and Hanley calls Irv Younger, hunts him down. He's then in Minneapolis. It's Sunday afternoon, and Judith answers the phone. Bob says to Judith, Judith, put Irv on the phone. And Judith says, oh, Bob, it's so good to hear from you. Look, we've got about a dozen guests for Sunday supper, and wonder, could Irv call you back? And Hanley says, Judith, this is big. This is important. Put him on the phone. I'll only take 5 minutes. Promise. And she says, well, okay, you promise. Because the roast is almost ready to serve and he's supposed to come to the roast. So Irv gets on the phone with Hanley, and 45 minutes later, after they're done talking about this argument and how to use it, Irv returns to the table in time for coffee and dessert. And here is what Bob Hanley did the next day talking about how AT&T had defended the case. And he's in final argument talking to the jury. He says, have you seen how they've defended this case? Yeah, it's interesting. The law does not require them to make sense. There is no legal obligation that your defense has to make sense. There's no legal obligation that you have one theory of the case. You can have as many as you like. Have you seen what they've done? If you don't like one thing, they got another argument. If you don't like that, they got another one. And it's almost like these people that's selling watches on the streets of New York, they roll up their sleeve, they're all these white. You don't like those? Well, here, let me show you the other sleeve. There's where the Rolexes are. It's like what they teach you in law school. You don't have to have a single theory of the case. It's in law school where they teach you, hey, take the simplest case you can possibly imagine. A farmer's got a patch of cabbages. His neighbor's got a goat. The neighbor's goat breaks loose. He gets into the cabbage patch. He eats the cabbages. And the farmer brings his lawsuit and he says, I have a patch of cabbages. Your goat ate my cabbages. The cabbages were worth $100. Pay me my $100. And if represented by these lawyers for AT&T, what would the defendant say? Number one, you had no cabbages. Number two, if you had any cabbages, they were not eaten. Number three, if your cabbages were eaten, it was not by a goat. Number four, if your cabbages were eaten by a goat, it wasn't my goat. And number five, if it was my goat, he was insane. And the jury chuckled, just like you did, to the tune of $1.8 billion. Quick, what's a third of $1.8 billion? That was Hanley, was that? It would be, what, 600? You got it, that's right. But it was not going to be six. It was going to be a paltry 5%, which would have been only 19 billion. Okay? But the case got retried. There is a law that says that all antitrust cases have to be tried more than once. And the what was tried the second time, Hanley was not there. He was in Morrison and Forrester in Denver. And the folks who tried it the second time did not do nearly so well. And AT&T had learned something important from their mistakes. All right. The lesson, you will have a coherent, consistent theory of the case. What suffers when you don't? Your credibility. Why is your credibility important? The people who heard yesterday already know, but you got to hear it again today because it's still true. And that is, you are the single most important witness in the case. What you do is literally stand up for your client and figuratively say, the facts that I am going to put on the witness stand are true. You can believe them. You can trust the argument that I make. And anything that you do that is inconsistent with your credibility, and having multiple theories of the case, inconsistent theories of the case, is that argument did not go to the merits of the case at all, did it? It went to the conduct of the other lawyer. And yet it was powerful, and that's why. Okay, the legal theory is just the starting point. It's only the framework. The law is not self actuating. The law is simply the framework for advocacy. It is only the bare bones rules of what makes a minimum theory that you can then take to the judge or jury. The law is only the guideline for the basic framework. It tells you very little about how you shape the case. It only gives you minimum requirements for getting past a motion for a directed verdict or summary judgment. That's all. It tells you very little about how you do what we're here to talk about. Okay? Now then, we're ready to see something about how the jury looks at all of this, because we've got to take the facts that we investigate and that we develop and we think about and we inquire about. We got to take that bundle of facts and we got to shape it and pad it into a coherent, consistent theory that we give to the fact finder. And doing that has to focus on how the fact finders approach things, right? Let me share with you some interesting stuff that comes from Palo Alto, California. The name of the researcher is Jeannie Fleming, Dr. Fleming. Is one of the heads of Metricus, which is an organization that deals with helping lawyers meet certain difficult persuasive problem. She's a jury research expert, among other things. Did a nationwide survey to find out how jurors feel about lawyers and how they feel about their task of deciding cases. You know, there is a consistent thread of anti-legalism among American jury. There is a feeling that what is legally correct may not always be the right thing to do. And in this study, Fleming found out that 60% of all American jurors said they thought it was more important to do the right thing than it was to do the legally correct thing. Now, one of the last things that you want to do is have your legal theory appear to be the wrong thing to do. If these percentages are correct, and I think they are, this is the initial mindset of potential jurors. Initially, 60% are prepared to say, well, in a conflict between the law and morality, we're on the side of morality. As Fleming said, they view the trial as a moral arena. And what this means is terribly important for you. It is your job to take the cause of action and find the underlying appeal to justice and articulate your cause of action in terms that strike the responsive chords in the judge and jury. Now, that sounds, in a sense, obvious. And yet, it's the biggest, most difficult job that we have. The most important thing that you can do is to identify and appeal to not the sense of justice, not doing the right thing, because we so often don't know what the right thing is. Now we're ready to talk about Edmund Nathaniel Kahn. Edmund Kahn in 1949 was a frustrated individual because he kept butting his head against the wall of definition. You see, Kahn was a jurisprude, an expert in jurisprudence. His subject, the philosophy of justice, the philosophy of the law. And as part of his work, one of the rites of passage for an expert in jurisprudence is to try to define justice. And every time Kahn tried to define justice, he would get disagreement from other scholars. And they would say, well, Kahn, maybe you're right about this, but you're wrong about this. And he says, every time he tried to define justice, all that happened was that it evoked contemplation. Didn't stir anybody. This beautiful phrase, he says, and contemplation bakes no loaves. Isn't that nice? Contemplation moves no one to action. Contemplation gets nothing done. He says, maybe this is because justice is not a true concept. Maybe it is an ideal that cannot be articulated with accuracy. If it can't be defined, then it may be a pseudo-concept, an ideal that we have that is incapable of definition. And he says, I think that's what it is. He says, if that's true, then justice is not a reality. It is an aspiration. But if justice is not real, injustice is. Everybody has been the victim of an injustice. Everybody has suffered injustice at the hands of other people or institutions or circumstances. Injustice, he says, is real. And injustice has the power to stir people's blood. If you want to motivate, you don't appeal to justice. If you want to motivate, you appeal to injustice. You draw on the fact finder's desire to right a wrong. Now we're honing things.
Now we are honing things. Now we are already seeing how you start to shape what you do. It is to articulate it so that it strikes the chord in the jury. This is wrong. Fix it. That's your job. That's why we're here. One of those powerful things that you can do in an opening statement. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here for Bill Barkley. He has come to court to ask you to right a wrong. And now you tell the story of what happened to him. And if that story says, yes, he was wronged, now you see you have already appealed to what is their sense of their role. I don't view the 60% as an aberration at all. I think doing justice means undoing injustice. And I think that's what motivates people. Edmund Nathaniel Kahn was absolutely right. Now, your job is to take the thing that are in every cause of action or defense that are injustices that the cause of action seeks to redress, or that are there are defenses because if the cause of action were to go forward, it would offend these other interests and create an injustice by permitting a recovery or whatever. In other words, every cause of action or defense speaks to particular injustices. Your job, find them, identify them, and talk about them in human language, in English, not in legal, in English. That's what your job is. What are the things that spark the sense of injustice? Well, treat equal people equally. The failure to treat equal people equally is an injustice. Now, here is Edmund Nathaniel Kahn, a Jewish scholar, 1949, just a couple of years, four, after the end of World War II, where the forces of darkness literally tried to obliterate his people. Here he is, against the history of that monumental injustice. And it would have been natural and understandable for him to talk about that as treat equal people equally. But he didn't. He picked the most prosaic, pedestrian kind of example that you could think of. His first example of treating equal people equally was, you have five people who go to a restaurant on Saturday night, and they all park in front of the restaurant, and they all come back out at about the same time, and there's a ticket on every car. So they all go to traffic court on Monday morning, and they all line up to appear in front of the traffic judge. Traffic judge looks at the first guy, and the first ticket says, no, parking in front of Rinaldi's restaurant, no big deal, case dismissed. Says the second one, huh, you're not the first one to have this. Well, I let the first one go, okay, but if I ever see you in here again. Says the third one, we can't have any more of this. Fine is $50. Says to the fourth one, there's something wrong going on in this community. $500. Says to the fifth one, you're going to send a message that this will stop. 6 months confinement at hard labor. You say, wait a minute. Now, stop for a second. Would it necessarily be evil or wrong or disproportionate to have a 6 month imprisonment for improper parking? Well, if you park your car so that you block the fire station exit, and there's a fire, and maybe you're even responsible for the loss of life. It is not that it is inherently wrong to have that stringent a punishment. It could be justified under some circumstances. It is that it's out of step with the rest. These people are equal. They're peas in a pod. No justification for treating them differently. That is the entire outrage that caused perhaps an overreaction with our sentencing requirements. Now look at the desire to have equal people treated equally. We have so many different lines of identification that it has become very difficult for judges to figure out what is equality under the particular guidelines of statute.
and the sentencing guidelines. It's tough. But the reason we've got them is the outrage that people had for exactly this kind of situation. Some people get a slap on the wrist. Other people get heavy punishment. That's not treating equal people equally. That's offensive. All right? Recognize basic human dignity. The example that Khan gives, this one does come out of war. A young man is found guilty of sedition, speaking against the government in time of war, urging people to evade the draft and all of that. He's found guilty. The judge could sentence this young man to death or to a long prison term. And as the young man appears before the judge for sentencing, the judge says, "You could be sentenced to death for your crime. I'm not going to do that. You could be put in jail for your crime. I'm not going to do that either. Instead, I'm going to be creative with this. You are going to be taken from here to a hospital where an operation will be performed on your vocal cords. You will no longer speak against the government. You will no longer speak. You will no longer have the capacity to speak, but only bark like a dog." And you say, "Wait a minute, that rankles. There's something wrong." And in our terms, in United States constitutional terms, we say, "Wait, that's cruel and unusual." What is the underlying thrust of cruel and unusual? It denies the defendant basic human dignity. When you deny basic human dignity, you are offensive to the sense of injustice. When you fail to treat equal people equally, you are offensive to the sense of injustice. And anybody who doesn't understand that has not been awake during the 20th century. Look at the civil rights movement. We're sometimes slow to identify equality, but when we identify them, the failure to accord equal treatment to equal people is offensive. But the women's movement sometimes are slow to identify equality. But when we do, we are offended by the failure to treat equal people equally. The notion behind give basic human dignity, that's a thrust that runs throughout the law. Okay? And what's another one? Failing to honor justified expectations. In other words, failing to honor contracts. If you got a system that won't enforce agreements that people intend to be enforced, and want and mean to be in court, then you're doing an injustice. Your job, to find the injustices, all right? That is the beginning of the shaping process. And if you don't understand this, you're going to miss the biggest motivating factor there is.
This is the end of tape 1, side 2. Program continues on tape 2.